Payroll of the Dead by Steve Frazee. When Jim Bennington knew for sure that the second Sioux was staying with him on the left bank of the river, he paddled his soggy boat closer to the heavy current on his right, despite his being a poor swimmer. The Yellowstone was running tawny from rains deep in the mountains. The crude craft was made of singed buffalo hides lashed to a framework of wild cherry wood. Bennington had started to pattern it along canoe lines, and more by accident than design, the boat had wound up tapered at both ends like the splinter of an angry cougar's eye. It rode low in the water, but it rode well when it was not 6 inches awash inside, as it was now from leakage of the pitch-daubed seams. 3 miles upstream, Bennington thought to stop and remelt his supply of pitch for a fresh caulking job. He was swinging toward shore when the overeager Sioux, painted black and red for the glory trail, rose in the willows and fired an arrow. The Sioux had knocked a second arrow, and the string was almost at his ear when Bennington raised his rifle. The boat spun with the current and was floating backward when a second warrior came leaping through the rust-brown willows. The rocking and pitching of the boat made him miss. The bullet ripped the apron of elk skin around the cockpit of the boat. By then, the current was spinning Bennington. He had to drop his rifle between his knees and grab the paddle as the boat crashed sideways into the curling wildness of fast water. He was paddling hard, and when he got straightened out, Bennington looked back and saw the Sioux dragging his companion up the bank. Great store these Lakotas set by the bodies of their dead. Bennington hoped that the survivor had his belly full for one day. It depended on his mettle as an individual. But no such luck, for the Indian then got on a gray horse and started following downriver. All the way from Sarcee country, small groups of Sioux had kept Bennington jumping. For some reason, the high plains were unduly astir. Bennington had hoped to save both work and trouble by sticking to the river. Now he had a fair share of both. The mettle of the Sioux was tough. He kept coming. The boat was getting so heavy that Bennington knew he would have to go ashore soon or sink. Leaping water swept him through a cut between bare hills. He saw the gray horse falling behind as it had to climb and then work its way across deep gullies. Riding almost in the middle of the river, Bennington scanned the east bank for a good landing place. He didn't like the looks of the wild water he would have to cross, but the thing to do was to put the river between him and the persistent Indian. He started to turn across the stream. A sudden rush of water came up around his thighs above the lashed cross pieces of the seat.
Oh, shoot!
A seam had popped, and there was no time to make it over to the right bank. With a landman's distrust of water, he had held himself ready to unload at any time. His cartridge bag and other items he could not afford to lose were around his neck on rawhide thongs, and his Remington was between his knees. The kayak still held together. He decided to make the west bank if he could, the near side, where a gravel bar of the color that gave the river its name came out like a long tongue. There was a wide streak of bad water between him and the slow swirling pool against the bar, but that didn't worry him as much as the position of the Sioux. The bow of the boat came around stubbornly as he dug his paddle deep and leaned on it. He was taking water fast, and it gave him a moment of panic. The bow came around. He began to paddle with all his might. He saw the rock too late. The boat went into it sideways and began to tip upstream. Bennington grabbed his rifle and kicked free. Still clinging hard to the rifle, he dog-paddled with both hands. It was partly the swing of the current and partly his own efforts that carried him out of the heavy surge of water and into the quiet rim of the pool beside the gravel bar. His feet struck bottom. He took 2 stumbling steps toward shore. The pool was cutting a hard, chill line just at the V of his buckskin shirt. The Sioux stepped to the edge of the gravel with his gun half raised. Bennington recognized it as an old English trade musket. The Sioux's round, hard eyes were both wide open as the rifle came against his shoulder. They didn't change, but his lips went tight, and the start of that was the warning Bennington acted on. Suddenly, he couldn't hear. He had no way at all to judge the success of his timing. The warrior was just lowering the musket when Jim surged up. Bennington brought his own rifle clear of the water. The Sioux, Unk Papa he was, dark and happy now, tossed his rifle aside and put an arrow to his bow. He made a motion of drawing it. He grinned when he saw how Bennington tensed himself to duck. Underwater, Bennington had shifted his rifle to his left hand. His knife was in his right.
Come out and fight me here!
I am not a beaver, White Rain, who loves the crows.
He knows who I am, and he knows that I was camping with Stunned Elk's horse stealers.
Neither of those thoughts was helpful. The small party of raiding crows with whom he had camped a few days while building a boat had thought him crazy. They had sat in the shade, shaking their heads as he lashed the framework of the boat together. 2 days before it was finished, they had gone down the Yellowstone on their ponies. Their opinion of Bennington must be right. No doubt they were alive and dry and healthy. He was up to his neck, 15 feet out in the water, facing a war-smeared Sioux who didn't give a damn about counting coup on a live white man. The Unkpapa's stone-solid eyes glinted as Bennington edged downstream. He was trapped. The Sioux was well aware of it, or Bennington would have been dead before this. Strong and seething, the river ran at Bennington's back. He could feel it holding his buckskins tight against his body. He could twist sidewise and dive for the heavy current, let his rifle go, and try to swim out of arrow range. It was only a flashing thought. He was not that kind of swimmer. Before he was across the white water that had wrecked his boat, the Sioux would have him stuck up with arrows. Without raising his bow to full position, the warrior sliced an arrow close to Bennington.
White Rain, who loves the crows.
Bennington threw his knife. It might have been a good throw, but the Sioux leaped aside with smooth, instinctive coordination of mind and coppery muscle. He was done with humor now. He raised the bow. Bennington drove sidewise into the current. He went under and felt the sudden rip of the wild, cold power against him. He came up in spite of himself. In spite of his efforts to dog paddle across the current, the river dragged him with it. He shot another desperate look across his shoulder, and this time, before the leaping water whacked the vision from his eyes, he saw a white man striding from the willows with a smoking rifle, and the Sioux was down. Otis Daymeyer made a fine figure of a man as he stood on the bank watching Bennington diving to recover his rifle. Daymeyer led on that he was all the way from St. Louis on some kind of army business that he had hinted at before he shut up, as if he didn't trust Bennington. Up from his third dive, Bennington rested, as well as a man could rest, neck deep in water with the cold soaked all the way into his marrow bones. Daymeyer looked like an officer, all right, Bennington judged. He was big-framed and lean, with the cavalryman's flat-muscled legs. His eyes were a bold, staring blue. His hair was dark bronze. It appeared that he had trimmed lately, with scissors, the curling tightness of his short beard. He had a wide mouth and full lips, the kind that can go in an instant from ready humor to cruelty.
You might have dropped it out in the current, Bennington. Try farther out.
Nobody was going to recover a rifle out in that current. But it wasn't there. It must be closer inshore, somewhere in the deep pool just beyond the strip of high bottom. 3 dives later, Bennington found it. He became cold, weary, and splashed toward shore. Daymeyer was dragging the dead Sioux toward the water.
Leave him there.
What?
He won't hide anything to dump him in the river. The Unkpapas will know we got him anyway.
How you know he's an Unkpapa?
I know.
He let it go at that. In the willows, the big gray horse came forward to meet Bennington. The saddle was Sioux, and so were the nose hitch and war rope. The brand on the hip was a big U.S. Bennington removed the saddle. Along the back and barrel of the horse, the marks of a McClellan saddle were still worn into the hair. He raised the mount's feet one by one. They were still well shod.
One of our horses, of course. I shouldn't be a bit surprised if they got him when they butchered the paymaster's guard a few weeks ago near Bismarck. You heard about that?
No.
Bennington put the saddle back on the horse.
How long you been out?
Over a year.
I see. Then you wouldn't hear much about army news, of course.
Not a word.
Bennington led the horse from the willows. Out in the white water, the rock was clean again. His rag of a boat had torn loose and floated away. Whoever had told him he was a boatsman?
Over a year, huh? You really lost track of civilization.
I catch up when I hit Fort Lincoln.
Former army man?
Yeah.
Confederate cavalry, no doubt.
Bennington looked at the teeth of the gray. 6 years old, he guessed.
Oh, so my accent still stick a little, huh?
Quite a little. Louisiana or Mississippi?
I was a private in the Iron Brigade, the 2nd Wisconsin.
No offense, Bennington. You still act cavalry to me. After the war?
I was in the 7th, yeah.
Fine regiment. They were camped on the Heart River when I came out. I stopped with them overnight. I knew Colonel Benteen during the war. How'd you like it?
Like war.
Service with the 7th.
Bennington had ridden since he was 5. That part of it was fine. But that was very little of his service. Most of it was boredom, waiting, regulations that galled after the easy discipline and hard-fighting unity of the Iron Brigade. For being drunk one night below New Fort Hays, Bennington had been put in the guardhouse pit on orders of Colonel Custer. Bennington remembered the pit, a hole in the ground, banked over with poles and dirt. He had spent 5 days there. That, too, was part of the service with the 7th Cavalry.
It was all right, if you like cavalry.
It so happens that I do. It's about mess time. Let's eat and talk something over.
Bennington was cleaning and drying his rifle when Daymire brought 2 horses from the willows downstream. The way the pack horse was laden, it looked as if Daymire intended to go all the way to the Columbia without shooting game. 20 feet from the dead Sioux, the 2 men cooked and ate.
I'll stand obliged for some hardtack and bacon, enough to take me down to Lincoln on the Gray.
You're not taking the Gray. It's government property. You're not going down to Fort Lincoln anyway, Bennington. I think you'll change your mind when you hear what I have to say. There's about $25,000 in the payroll wagon old Sitting Bull got a few weeks ago. At least it was some of Bull's warriors, we're sure. They may have thrown the money away by now. Again, maybe not. My job is to find out and to recover any part of it that's left.
Oh, that's some job.
The Army thinks it's worth a try. The Sioux have no use for money. Probably don't know the meaning of it. They killed the paymaster's guard and looted the wagon in hopes of finding arms, perhaps. At any rate, we know they carried off the money.
Near Bismarck?
Yeah. It's scattered on the prairie from there to the head of the Missouri.
Bennington looked out at the river. He was anxious to be on his way.
I'm ordered to go right to Sitting Bull himself to see what can be done.
That was an easy order for somebody to give. You know where he is?
We heard the White Rain Mountains. I'll be frank with you. I had an army scout with me until I told him what the orders were. He turned around and rode back. It wasn't all chance that brought me here in time to save your hide, Bennington. I've been watching you for 2 days.
Oh? How so?
2 days ago, I met the Sioux you were camped with when you were building your boat. Old Stundell could talk a little English, and I can work my hands fairly well. He told me you'd be coming down the Yellowstone any time if you lived to make it. He barely did.
Did you reload that rifle after you shot?
Surprised at the sudden veering, Daymire stared at Bennington, and then he colored slightly.
I didn't, for a fact. I still had the Colt.
Sure.
Bennington picked up the war rope of the gray.
Sitting Bull may be in the White Rain Mountains, or on the Rosebud, or clear up on the Marias. How about that hardtack and bacon, Lieutenant?
Captain Daymire.
Daymire watched Bennington's hand on the war rope.
That's government property, mister. I'll need that horse. The supplies I can spare you, but not the gray.
Bennington could make a fight of it and take the horse. It would be a bad fight, too. He might have to hurt Daymire. He kept looking at the officer and knew it would be worse than that. He would have to kill Daymire to get the gray. After all, the man was going in and Bennington was going out. It didn't make sense to fight a fellow white man and an army captain in the bargain over a government horse. Bennington thought it over. When he was sure that he was not backing down, he dropped the war rope.
You've been out a year. Why not another week or two?
It's a crazy job. You wasting your time, Daymire.
Couldn't you find Sitting Bull's Oglala's?
Sure, I could find Sitting Bull.
Well then, I know you can do it. Stundell told me you were one of the best.
Yeah, show me and Charlie Reynolds and Yellowstone Kelly. No thanks, Daymire.
That's odd. Lonesome Charlie Reynolds was the scout who turned back on me.
He's smart.
Take the gray, Bennington. I'll get along.
Daymire walked over to his pack horse. the order-dedicated Indian ignorant idiot was going through with it. Maybe he was a fool, but you had to hand it to him for having guts and determination. And he had not tried to prod Bennington with any hints about being paid as a scout. Bennington looked at the captain's rifle leaning against the log, still unloaded. Wasn't that something? Yet except for that rifle, Bennington would be lying dead somewhere along the gravel bar with his legs in the water, with a round area gleaming on his skull. Daymeyer was digging into his pack.
Never mind.
He got on the gray and started upriver. He'd always been somewhat of a fool himself. Captain Daymeyer came along behind him without a word. Daymeyer showed no triumph. He acted as if he had known from the first that Bennington would go along with him. With brass and confidence like that, the man would be a brigadier before his hair was gray. The Sioux that Bennington had pumped through the stomach was not dead. He lay where his companion had dragged him, and his horse, a mean-looking blue pony, was still close to him.
Well, by Judas!
Daymeyer drew his pistol.
Put that away.
Bennington got down and knelt beside the dying Sioux. The glazing eyes cleared for an instant as hatred swept the cloud away.
Sitting Bull, where is he?
The Indian's eyelids flickered. He got his hand on his knife, and there was still a little strength in him as he struggled to keep Bennington from taking it out of his hand. When his wrist failed, the Sioux tried to bend his head down to bite Bennington's wrist.
No, it ain't no use, Daymeyer.
Daymeyer still had his pistol in his hand.
You alone the next time you don't listen to me.
He could have crawled away and got well. Look what happened when they shot Rain in the face and bayoneted him and left him for dead.
Yeah, well, you listen to me from now on. I'll take that pony and you can go it alone.
You're the scout. I'll listen.
Bennington led the pony close to the Sioux. As a gesture of respect to the warrior, he wished to kill it, but he didn't like the idea of another unnecessary shot. He tied the pony to the willows. Other Sioux would be here before long. The land was swarming with them. Until dusk, Bennington set a fast pace. They were between the Rosebud and the mouth of the Bighorn River. Just before dark, they crossed the Yellowstone, went over two long ranges of dry hills, and camped at Red Springs. Bennington was uneasy then. They had not seen an Indian all afternoon, or any fresh sign. Daymeyer had wanted a fire, but Bennington had said no, and there was no fire. Now Daymeyer was in his blankets, not worrying about anything.
Quiet, huh?
Quiet enough for us to lose our horses. I stand the first 4 hours to midnight.
Fair enough.
Where did Lonesome Charlie turn back?
About 20 miles out of Lincoln. Why?
Well, he all right? He wasn't sick, was he?
No. He told me it was a fool's mission.
Uh-huh. Who assigned him to you?
Colonel Custer, of course.
Charlie Reynolds was not the kind to turn back for anything less than extraordinary reasons. But maybe he had thought Captain Daymeyer was reason enough. No Army scout was forced to take idiotic orders like a soldier. Still, it worried Bennington. It didn't worry Daymeyer at all. He went to sleep in 5 minutes. Bennington kept thumping him with the toe of his moccasin, making him turn over. Between going out to the horses and trotting back to keep Daymeyer's snores from being heard by every restless Sioux in Montana territory, Bennington spent a bad 4 hours. He didn't trust Daymeyer after the first watch was over. For a while, Bennington lay unsleeping in his blankets. But Daymeyer stayed alert. He went out to the horses. He moved around without too much noise. Bennington went to sleep. 4 hours a night was about all either of them would get from now on. At 4 in the morning, Daymeyer was ready to go on. Whatever else he lacked, he had toughness and an eagerness to do his job. They quartered away from the rising sun, riding the long rolling hills. It was a big and lonely land they crossed, and it seemed to be uninhabited. Bennington had seen it that way at times, but he had never accepted a clump of trees, a thicket, the willows beside a stream, or any other cover at face value.
Who said a Sitting Bull was in the White Plains?
Scouts. Bloody Knife and some of the others Custer seemed to trust so much.
It didn't matter. The White Rains were as good a place as any to head for. They would find Sitting Bull when they ran into Sioux who were disposed to, or could be persuaded to, take white men to him. Some of it depended on the fact not being known that the two of them had killed High Wound and the other Unkpapa. In the afternoon, they were 15 miles from the Yellowstone, going southwest toward Tulloch Forks. Bennington held it unlikely that they would reach the Little Bighorn without running headlong into Sioux. He kept wondering about the marks of wood cutting he had seen late yesterday afternoon. While they were still on the west bank of the river, he had looked across the swift water and had seen where trees had been chopped on the east bank, even cottonwoods that burned poorly in steamboat fireboxes. Daymire had been ducking branches and hustling the packhorse along. Bennington doubted that he had observed the marks across the river.
How long were you at Fort Lincoln?
Several days.
Then your steamers go up to Missouri?
I heard that the Far West left from Fort Buford sometime last month on army business.
Oh, to the Yellowstone?
Up the Yellowstone, they said.
The Far West was nearly 200 feet long. It could be handled on the Yellowstone, Bennington guessed, but it would be a mean and dangerous task.
Where was it headed?
I haven't the least idea. I'm only a dumb captain.
What outfit?
The 6 engineers.
Engineers.
The engineers could corduroy a road through a swamp or maybe get some sort of boat bridge across a river. But what did they know about Indians?
I'll find out about that pose before it is over.
Bennington found out soon. There were about 25 in the bunch. Daymire and Bennington came upon them unexpectedly, if you could call a quarter of a mile distance coming upon. It was close enough. There were men, women, and children in the bunch. Immediately, there was a furious stirring of movement. The women and the kids went at a run up a ridge. Bennington saw a child fall from a travoy. An old squaw with her gray hair streaming dropped off a calico pony and scooped up the child, running with him. Bennington saw a headdress blossom suddenly on one of the warriors milling between him and the fleeing squaws. Two of the bucks cut off at a high lope to gain the top of a knobby hill. The others seemed to be racing aimlessly, kicking dust in all directions. It was a heap of activity for the size of the alarm. Two white men sitting their horses quietly on a ridge. Bennington made the peace signal.
You just sit, Dame Ma. They coming.
Good. What kind of Sioux?
I don't know.
He and Daymire had excited the band far too much for normal circumstances. He saw the feathers in the tails of the ponies as the Indians came charging.
Now sit quiet. Don't you get excited.
Take some of that medicine yourself, White Rain.
The Indians split their charge, winging out on both sides of the motionless white men. In the center rode the chief.
Musical bugger.
Bennington looked from side to side. The flankers were obeying. They were watching their chief. For the moment, at least, everything depended on the man with the headdress. The chief slowed his pony from its flashing run. He shifted his rifle and raised his arm, and then he dropped down to a walk and came up the hill toward the white man. They were Cheyennes, Bennington saw then. The chief was Blue Buffalo. 3 years before, Bennington had seen him in the camp of the Oglalas, with whom the Cheyennes were strong brothers. Bennington dropped his hand and made the signs.
I'm glad to see Blue Buffalo once more.
For just an instant, his use of the chief's name raised little sparks of surprise in the Cheyenne's eyes. The warriors crowded in, dark with suspicion and hatred. Magnificent physical specimens they were, the tallest and the most clean-cut of all Plains tribes. One of them reached out to snatch Daymire's rifle. Without moving the weapon, Daymire shook his head, smiling. His eyes were like round rocks, and there was no fear in them. The warrior wheeled his pony back and raised a Springfield carbine.
We have seen too much blood. Blue Buffalo says it.
The warrior lowered the carbine and rode to the outer edge of the group. Across the hills, the squaws had stopped and were looking back, with the dust of their flight settling around them.
Well, we are in peace. We will speak with Tatanka. We heard he's in the White Rain Mountains.
Blue Buffalo was willing to parley, but he did not get down to go through the usual ceremonies. Urgency was in him. It might be, too, Bennington thought, that guilt was riding him. At least, he was not at ease. His eyes moved with a sharp kind of worry as he followed Bennington's casual glances at certain equipment of the warriors. 5 or 6 Springfield carbines, shot boxes of army issue, A sergeant's chevrons on a patch of torn blue cloth tied in the tail of one of the ponies.
Tatanka is gone.
Where has he gone?
Down the Rosebud, beyond the Yellowstone. Far away.
Another warrior slammed his pony in close to Daymire. He held a knife close to the captain's face.
Put that away, bucko, or I'll drop your guts in your lap with it.
The warrior did not understand the words, but he understood the fearlessness of the captain. Blue Buffalo waved the buck aside.
You are scouts for Man Without Hip?
For General Terry. Bennington shook his head.
For White Whiskers?
General Gibbon. Bennington shook his head.
Alone we seek Tatanka to speak with him.
Blue Buffalo pointed north and east toward the Rosebud. He started to turn away. One of the Cheyennes pointed at Bennington.
He rides the horse of Stab Bear.
Before that, he was the horse of the Great White Father, and now it is again.
Blue Buffalo put his pony around again. Fury glittered in his look as he watched Bennington. And then the heat began to die. He became sullen, discouraged, almost afraid. He waved for his warriors to follow him. The warrior who had turned back from grabbing Daymire's rifle swerved his pony and struck the captain across the shoulder with a string of scalps. Daymire smiled faintly.
The next two I shoot in the guts won't get a mercy shot.
It was not worth saying that the band was Cheyenne, not Sioux. For a man who knew little about Indians, Daymire had stood up to their bullying tactics like a veteran. Maybe it was not so important to know one tribe from another. Maybe the army knew its business after all when it sent Daymire. But Bennington was not obliged to like him. A man without fear was inhuman.
What did they say about Sitting Bull?
We're going the wrong way.
Maybe they lied.
Yeah, maybe they did.
Bennington turned the gray and started across the hills toward the Rosebud. Daymire followed him.
They'd been in a scrap against our cavalry, did you notice?
How could he have missed noticing? Three Springfield carbines, odds and ends of cavalry equipment, but there had not been an army horse in the bunch. Blue Buffalo was headed toward one of the reservations. Before he reached there, the carbines and other army gear would be well concealed. Blue Buffalo had been ill at ease. There had been guilt in that repeated talk about too much blood already. Whatever kind of skirmish the Cheyennes had been in, they had won, or else they would have been in a much uglier mood.
Did the Sioux burn that payroll wagon?
No, why?
I bet they burned it. There went your money, Daymire. We risking our hair over nothing.
They took the money, be sure of that. All we have to do is find out how much of it they hung on to. How far to the Yellowstone?
Well, we ain't to the Rosebud yet.
Bennington remembered something that had flashed in and out of his mind while they were waiting for the Cheyennes to come up.
Where'd you get my name, White Rain?
From Stunned Elk's bunch.
Tell me something about Stunned Elk's braid, Daymire.
One of them was turning gray. The other was still mostly black. It gave him a lopsided look.
That was Stunned Elk, sure enough. But the Crows had their own name for Bennington. Cha, Wolf Hair.
You didn't get my name from Stunned Elk, Daymire.
Daymire gave the impression of shrugging.
Where are we likely to run into the Sioux again?
Anywhere.
The young papa Daymire had killed by the river had called Bennington by name at least twice. But Daymire was not supposed to understand Sioux.
You heard Stab Bear use my name, Daymire.
Stab Bear?
Yeah, the unk papa you killed.
Stab Bear. White Rain. Sure, I heard him. I understand enough Lakota to catch a few words now and then. It's like letting people think you're stone deaf. You hear a lot you wouldn't catch otherwise.
If you were that near, you sure shaved things close before you shot him.
Didn't I? It was a funny sight, you'll have to allow. You up to your ears in water, the Sioux slicing arrows at you. I got him in time, what more do you want?
They struck the Rosebud the next morning. Bennington had gone up it in June the year before when the delicate aroma of wild roses filled the whole valley. Now there was the biting smell of hot dust raised by the horses.
What month is this?
July the 13th. July 13, 1876.
Of Indian sign, there was plenty. All along the way, the grass had been grazed down by the ponies. There were campsites where lodge poles still stood. The staked circles and the fire pits were weeks old, but the enormity of the campsite, strung for miles along the river, made Bennington uneasy. Thousands of Sioux had ridden here this summer. The unshod hoofs of their ponies had pounded a trail hundreds of yards wide beside the stream. There were marks of shod horses, too, widely dispersed among the more blurry outlines of the plains ponies. Cavalry, even under the most careless of lieutenants on scout, did not spread out like that. Bennington rode with a tingling down his spine. He was not positive about the picture he was reading here, but it seemed to have an ugly look. When they stopped to rest the horses at noon, he found an army canteen under a bulberry bush.
Some careless crew to pay for that.
I say he already done that.
The Indians run off a batch of army horses for certain, wouldn't you say?
Bennington looked out at the marks of Plains cavalry that had passed in numbers greater than the strength of some corps he had seen during the war. He was tired of jostling words with Captain Daymire of the 6th Engineers, who said the obvious or lied beyond comprehension. They made 25 miles that day and were still about 25 miles from the Yellowstone when they camped. Again, Bennington took the first watch, sitting in a clump of bushes far enough from the Rosebud River so that the sound of it neither lulled him nor dulled his ears. Tonight, Daymire slept silently. It seemed to Bennington that the host which had passed up and down the valley was all around him now in the ghostly starlight, not threatening but riding by in endless strength, going to some appointed place. The pale set stars and a sensing of time slipping through the barrier of midnight told Bennington when to rouse Daymire, who came from his blankets instantly alert. Daymire pulled on his boots.
Strangely quiet, isn't it?
Yeah, the Indians are long gone from here.
Tomorrow we'll find them.
We're weeks behind this migration.
Suddenly, Bennington had a hope and a wish that Captain Daymire would give up when they reached the Yellowstone again.
Weeks, then. We'll find them.
In the morning, Daymire was eager to move on. Bennington had never seen a man so anxious to find Sioux. All the way down to Rosebud, Bennington looked moodily at the fat U-marks of steel-foot horses sprinkled among the tramplings of thousands of ponies. It was no small scout detail the Sioux had rubbed out to get those horses. Of course, it was possible that each horse did not represent a dead cavalryman. The Indians might have stampeded the mounts of several companies engaged in a skirmish.
Did soldiers go up the river from Buford with the Far West?
I think so. A few companies of cavalry pacing along the bank. Some of the 6th Infantry on the boat itself. Why?
It was always why with Captain Daymire. Bennington didn't answer. He kept searching out marks of shod horses in the wide trail.
That's not our business. Forget everything but our orders.
Now it was our business and our orders, as Daymire assumed that Bennington was solidly stuck with the detail. That was not the case at all. Daymire just might lose a second scout when they came to the Yellowstone.
How far to the Yellowstone now?
We'll get there soon enough.
They came upon a dead horse, a cavalry mount with the McClellan still on it. Bennington got down and walked around it. The horse had been shot in the head at close range. He stepped close and lifted the canteen on the saddle. It was empty. The horse had bloated and popped, and now the flesh was sagging away, and the yellow teeth of the animal made a long snarl.
Let's get on.
A mile farther on, he pointed to the left.
Let's cut across to the islands. We can make an easier ford there, rather than following the Rosebud all the way down.
That was so, but how did Daymire know it? He had given the impression of being lost ever since Bennington met him.
The Sioux stayed with the Rosebud.
Bully for them. Let's cut off toward the islands. We'll find the Sioux if we just keep riding in their general direction.
He was right, but Bennington still wanted to be stubborn. His dislike of the man had grown to where it overshadowed his puzzling about Daymire's character.
Is there any particular advantage in staying right in the middle of this Indian pack?
Bennington led the way off to the west, toward the islands in the Yellowstone. They came to the river, and Bennington stopped to cool the horses before making the crossing.
We gone in a circle almost. How you know these islands were here in the bend?
Good Lord, man, I rode past the islands on the way to find you. Besides, I got a map.
Yeah, I might let you depend on that map from here on.
Another boating expedition, huh?
No, I'll ride.
Do so if you wish. What's the best route for me to take after I cross?
Bennington felt like cursing, but he knew he was gonna stick. At the first, if he had known how much of a liar Daymire was, he would not have gone with him. Clever liars were generally also clever cowards, but Daymire was a combination that utterly stumped Bennington.
Say we reach Sitting Bull. All you're obliged to do is get some report of what happened to that money, is that right?
Are you suggesting something else?
You don't expect to recover any of that money, do you?
I do, if they've got any of it. Every note goes back to the government. Were you hinting at something else?
Bennington had not been hinting at anything else. He'd been trying to estimate the length of their stay in Sitting Bull's camp in case they ever got there. For his part, he wished to visit the Sioux as briefly as possible.
You see that I get paid as a scout?
I'll try. That's all I can promise.
No amount of money was worth the risk that lay ahead. If Daymire had made at any time glib promises about Bennington's being rewarded for his services, Bennington would have distrusted him. But now the officer's blunt honesty in the face of his own need of help settled Bennington's mind. Bennington studied out the first island. It was covered with a dense growth of willows, and the upstream end of it was strewn with debris from floods. Most of the heavy water was on the far side, for the stream between here and the island was shallow enough to show bottom. The river was less than belly deep on the horse as Bennington approached the island. He was turning to see how Daymire was coming with the pack horse when he saw a small movement in the willows. There was one Sioux crouched low. He rose as Bennington turned his rifle to bear on him. Then there were a dozen Indians who rose suddenly to full height from the willows. Bennington saw the rifles, the war arrows ready on the bows, the grim, dark faces. Even devoid of paint, they were the most murderous-looking band of Ogallala bad faces Bennington had ever encountered. Their coppery skins were gleaming wet from the swim to the island. The white men had stumbled into the trap with no resistance, so that for a moment the Sioux were at a loss. It would not last long, their lack of design. Fear rocked up and down in Bennington, but his face was grave as he rested his rifle across his thighs.
We seek Tatanka Watanka. Don't you try anything now, Captain.
I guess we found him, didn't we?
Daymire came splashing on, and several warriors waded out to meet him. They cut the tow rope of the pack horse. They punched at the pack, testing for loot as they brought Daymire ashore. A brawny warrior grinned at Daymire.
Friend.
He reached a hand up, and like a fool, the captain reached down to meet the gesture. They pounded him brutally while they were taking his weapons. They turned to Bennington, closing in around him.
We are here in peace. We're not scouts. We have come from the White Father to speak to Tatanka.
Tatanka does not speak to mice. Tatanka sets the hooves of his pony on mice and on white men's soldiers. Tatanka does not know the White Father.
He will speak to us. The White Father sent us, and we are only two.
Still on his horse, Bennington knew that he held a small advantage. He glanced down at Daymire. The captain's face was bloody. The roughing he had taken had roused a horrible temper in him, and now, with the tension centered on Bennington, Daymire was sizing up the chances more from the standpoint of anger than from logic.
I will not argue with children. We have come to see the water pour, whose medicine is powerful. He's dreamed already of our coming. He'll be displeased if his dream is violated by careless children.
Hear the big words of this white man, this mouse, whose heart squeaked with terror when he saw us.
White Rain has said his words.
Bennington gave the warriors a contemptuous look, and then he raised his eyes to look above their heads as if they were miserable objects who did not concern him. But from the edge of his eye, he watched Daymire. Daymire was not as hurt as he had pretended. He was reaching under his shirt. The idiot had some kind of small handgun there. He was pulling it free when Bennington swung his rifle. The barrel cracked down on Daymire's head. The warriors close to Daymire fell back. Bennington dropped from his horse quickly and took the wicked little handgun away from Daymire. A big Ogallala stepped in to crush the captain's head with a war axe. Bennington shoved him back with an open hand.
My friend is a child, too.
Bennington tossed the handgun down.
We've come to see Tatanka. We've had enough of your foolish acts.
The Sioux went into council. Two of them had recognized the gray horse. They were in favor of killing the white men without further delay. Older warriors ruled against them. After all, White Rain had spoken of a dream. Tatanka had many dreams. Perhaps White Rain had spoken with a split tongue, but it was not safe to disregard dreams. Better to let Tatanka Watanka decide if the white men were liars. All the heat was out of Daymire, and the shrewd determination was in his face again.
I almost ruined it, didn't I? Are they taking us to Old Bull?
Well, we see.
The bad faces took the white men's weapons. Two of the younger warriors started to loot the pack and were stopped by Clouds Floating, a scarred Oglala who seemed to have the most rank.
We go to Tatanka.
What did he say about Sitting Bull?
And taking us to his camp.
We did it.
For 3 days, they rode northward with the Sioux. They crossed the Missouri and continued on into country that Bennington didn't know. When they crossed the trail of a Crow war party, five of the warriors and three of the young boys went after their ancient enemies. Late on the fourth day, Bennington saw the Sioux camp ahead. It was the largest he had ever seen.
Hi-ya!
Clouds Floating went zigzagging ahead on his pony. The rest of the escort, stolid with their importance, took Bennington and Daymire on at a steady pace. Bennington held to a solemn expression as he made a quick estimate of the number of big cavalry horses in the herd. There were at least 200. He gave Daymire a bitter look, but the captain's eyes were on the camp. The excitement Clouds Floating had raised by his approach, the signal that he had found white men, was dying away as the Sioux escort took Bennington and Daymire past lodges of the Minneconju, Brule, and Sans Arc. On ahead, set apart from all the others, Bennington saw a yellow council tent. A group of chiefs stopped the escort and asked questions. Bennington recognized Gaul, in whose camp he had once spent a month. Black thoughts were setting behind Gaul's face as he looked at Bennington, who gave the signs that he was glad to see the chief again. Gaul turned away. Behind him, banks of stone-faced warriors stood silent, their faces bad. And it was that way as the escort took the white men on through the camp, a bad quietness and a hatred showing starkly in all the Sioux. The chiefs now walked ahead of the cavalcade and the crowd closed in behind. Captain Daymire swung his head from side to side and watched the camp with high contempt. It was the right thing to do, but he was not acting, and therein lay another dark bundle of worry for Bennington. The Sioux understood acting and could admire it, but a genuine contempt of them was a deadly mistake. 200 cavalry horses were in their pony herd at this moment because someone had shown contempt of a great free people. They came to the red and black lodge of Sitting Bull. Tatanka stood before it with Rain in the Face, whose eyes were glowing with cruel, sharp intelligence. Rain in the Face was standing by aid of a stick crutch, and Bennington saw the queer hanging of his foot, as if the toes could only touch the ground.
The White Father has sent a soldier in White Rain to speak to Tatanka Watanka.
The down-drooping lips of the Sioux's greatest medicine man tightened. The deep lines running from the corners of his bold nose grew stronger. His cloudy eyes looked at the white men as if they were pieces of spoiled meat. Sitting Bull had grown gray listening to the broken words of white men. He turned his back and went into his lodge. Hobbling on his crutch, Rain in the Face followed him.
That was the old boy himself. Tell him to come back out here. Tell him
why don't you shut up.
Bennington watched Gaul and Bad Hip and Little Wound go into an impromptu conference. Clouds Floating stood aside, glowering, angry, as if he had been reprimanded for bringing the white men into camp. Sitting Bull had turned his back upon them, and now their position was worse than precarious. The warriors grabbed the bridles of the horses and led them away. Gaul had saved their hides. Peasy, the irreconcilable, the white man-hater, the true hard man of the Sioux. Inside a lodge guarded by the Akasita, the Indian police, Bennington stood between the door flap and the fire pit and fought down a desire to kill Daymeyer with his bare hands. From what he had learned from Cloud's floating, from what he had seen in the camp, the cavalry horses, the great number of wounded Sioux, Bennington had pieced together a grim and ugly picture. Daymeyer sat down on a pile of buffalo robes. He started to pull off his boots.
Give me a hand here, will you?
When Bennington didn't move, Daymeyer lay back on the robes.
You wouldn't believe it, but I'm a little tired. When will we have the council with old Bull?
We never will. You start telling the truth or I'm gonna kill you.
Daymeyer started to smile, and then gave proper assessment to what he had heard, and his face grew sober.
I think you've guessed the truth, Bennington. You came along of your own free will, so don't act like a Puritan now.
You better talk, Daymeyer.
The cavalry had a couple of scraps with the Sioux. Crook got his nose bloodied, Custer lost half his command, about 300 men, over the Little Bighorn. He got killed himself, by the way.
Now I said I want the truth.
You're getting it. You damn fool. You think any man is immortal? Custer lost 5 companies of the 7th, right down to the last man. Reno and Benteen took a bad mauling, but the infantry came up the river in time to save them.
You know, officer, you never were.
That's right. I'm a man looking out for himself the same as you. There was no paymaster's wagon robbed near Bismarck. You guessed that before we started across the Yellowstone a second time. But don't fret yourself. There's money here for us. All we have to do is talk Sitting Bull out of it, and that can be done.
What money?
The 7th was paid about a month before the fight. They never had a chance to spend a cent. Most of that money is right here in this camp, Bennington. Figure the privates at $13, about 300 of them.
Bennington turned away with a sickness in him. He stumbled to the door of the lodge and looked out directly at a fox warrior standing guard 20 feet away. Beyond the Sioux, a group of curious children were watching the tent. One of them had a rag on a willow stick. It was the lower bar of a swallow-tailed pennant, a blue bar with the handles of crossed sabers standing against it in white. Bennington had seen it many times, George Custer's personal pennant.
Even if half of it was thrown away or lost, we can still figure on several $1,000s. It's nobody's money, Bennington. The Indians have no use for it. I've got an idea what to tell them about it, but you'll have to make the spiel, of course.
The warrior waved the children away. They trotted off, the blue bar waving and flapping on the stick. Bennington grasped the sides of the opening, gathering the hide in a grip that made his knuckles stand white.
You filthy, miserable bastard.
Right at the start, I saw you were soft inside, Bennington. That's right, we're stuck. We gotta work together. What we think of each other has nothing to do with the problem. Here's what you tell them, Bennington. Those green pieces of paper they took had the names and identification of the soldiers they killed. They chopped the dead into pieces. You know how the Sioux perform. Tell old Bull that the White Father has to know who his dead soldiers are so he can do them honor. The only way he can tell is to have the pieces of green paper. It ought to work, don't you think? The Sioux honor their dead enemies. And we're not asking for anything that's useful to them.
It might work.
Good. And we're agreed. A third of the money goes to you. That beats $100, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
When do you suppose we'll have a council? Tonight?
Likely.
Bennington looked through the doorway, past the Akasita guards, onto the free hills beyond the stream where the camp was set. Custer wiped out? On the Little Bighorn? It wasn't possible. There had been fighting, yes, and the cavalry had been hurt, but a tall Cheyenne named Cutarm came by with a hunting party that was blood-smeared. Bennington kept staring at the horse the tall Cutarm rode, and when the hunting party went on, Bennington followed the horse with his eyes. The sorrel was one of Custer's favorite horses, white-stockinged all the way around, a blazed forehead. Its name was Vic. Bennington looked at Daymeyer, who was sleeping peacefully. Somewhere in the valley of the greasy grass, near the bright blue loops of the river, was it? Bennington knew the country well. He and Daymeyer had been almost there when they turned back to the Rosebud after meeting the Cheyennes. Darkness came, and there was a council. Bennington heard the crier going about the camp.
Two white soldiers who fought against us on the greasy grass have come into the camp to speak to Tatanka, who will not hear their words. The chiefs will counsel. High Wound and Stab Bear of the great Unkpapas have been killed by these two white men.
A silence came upon the camp. After 2 hours, the council ended. No one came for the white men.
Tell these guards you want to talk to Sitting Bull.
You tell them.
Sometime later, a man came into the darkness of the lodge.
Why are you here?
Bennington told the visitor that the quarrel of the White Father with the Sioux was one thing, and that the honoring of dead on both sides was another thing.
The White Father did not send us to say that there'll be no more fighting or ask the Sioux not to fight again. We're not chiefs, we're only men. With the pieces of paper, we will know the dead and we'll honor them. This is all we ask of the Sioux, who honor their warriors who die bravely too.
There was a long silence from the man who stood before Bennington. Meager starlight came through the smoke hole of the lodge, but it was not enough to reveal more than the gloomy outlines of the Sioux. Doubt rode the Indian's silence.
These pieces of paper are traded among white men, as ponies are traded among my people.
It is so. The pieces of green paper used among white men to buy what they wish from each other. But if the paper is returned to us, it'll be used only to honor the soldiers who were killed.
5 suns ago, a dream was told in this camp. In the dream, 4 white men were seen riding to the camp. They came to say that the White Father wishes peace, that the soldiers, even now hunting for the Sioux, will be sent away. You have not said this. You are only 2. Where are the other 2?
This time, it was Bennington who was long silent, with his mind racing over the implications of the statement and the questions. When the visitor first spoke, he had been reasonably sure of his identity, and now he was certain.
Will White Rain be heard by council?
Bennington took his time. His next words would trap him hopelessly if he had guessed wrong, or they would save both him and Daymire.
The dream was good. There were 4 white men sent. One turned back from fear. The other grew so sick with boils upon his back that he couldn't ride. 2 are here. The others were chiefs, and the White Father had told them to speak to the Sioux to say that the soldiers would be sent away, to say that peace would be. Now, I'm not a chief, and my friend is not a chief. We were to ask only for the pieces of paper to honor our dead. But I know what the others were to say, and so I say it to the council. The dream was good.
After a moment, Sitting Bull turned swiftly and ducked through the lodge opening and was gone.
What was that about?
A bargain? Yes. Surely it must be a bargain. Tatanka was no chief. He was not even a warrior. There were Sioux who said he had no heart for fighting. It was known that he never went into battle. And yet he was the strong man of the Sioux and ruled a large number of them through a mixture of intelligence and medicine.
Who was that? What'd he say?
I thought you understood some Sioux.
Not the way you two grunted it. Who was it? Did you ask him about the money?
It was Pate. He said he would see about that money.
Pate? Sitting Bull's the man we want.
Pate is sacred to the Sioux.
Did this Pate say we would get the money?
He said that the council would hear us.
They were taken in mid-morning to the meeting of chiefs outside the Yellow Lodge. The Sioux war leaders had already passed through their ceremonies. No pipe was offered the white men, no gestures of respect. They came as beggars to be heard. Bennington had a long, bad moment when he looked at the hostile faces. Rain in the Face, Kicking Bear, Peasy, the great straight man of the Sioux, Crazy Horse, Bear Rib, Bad Hip, Little Chief of the Cheyennes, and many others. Sitting Bull was there, dressed in a black and white calico shirt, his strong legs wrapped in leggings of black cloth, his cloudy eyes showing nothing, his gray hair running down to frame his broad face into narrowness.
The Sioux gave Little Chief the honor of speaking all the wrongs long held against the white man by the Sioux and Cheyenne. The list was long. His voice was good. After a long time, Little Chief wanted to know why two white men had come here. In the strong daylight, with the unwavering eyes of a fierce people upon him, Bennington found the lie hard to tell, but he told it with all the power and imagery he could muster. The council listened. They were not impressed by the white father's need of small scraps of green paper to tell the names of his dead soldiers on the greasy grass. Bennington knew that he had to do much better. He spoke of the dream.
When we left the fort on the river, we said among ourselves that our coming was known. Tatanka Watanka sees that which others do not see, so we were sure that he knew of our coming. There were four of us. One grew sick and fear overcame the other, and two of us are here. The other two were to speak of peace. Now, I do not know everything they were to say, and so I will not make up words. But I do know that they were to speak to Tatanka and the chiefs about peace.
Bennington saw belief come to the faces of the Sioux. It was simple for them to believe what they had heard already from Sitting Bull. Behind the chiefs, the listening warriors shifted their eyes to the medicine man, paying respect. Sitting Bull showed nothing. His eyes were drawn down tightly. His thin upper lip jutted slightly over the lower. He sat with his arms crossed, and he gave the impression that he had heard nothing. There was no more for Bennington to say. He looked above the Sioux, beyond the pony herd, out to the tawny hills. He was sweating. He waited. Kicking Bear was the first to speak.
We will consider the words of the white man.
Gall motioned to the picked warriors of the Akasita. They escorted Bennington and Daymire back to the lodge.
Sitting Bull never opened his mouth. What happened? Did we get the money?
We see.
You're cool enough about it. Did you purposely foul everything up? I wish to hell I brought somebody I could trust.
What really happened to Charlie Reynolds, Daymire?
He was killed in a Little Bighorn. You didn't swallow all the lies I told you, did you?
I'm afraid so.
The guards went away before noon. A short time later, the procession started. No warrior or even a toothless old man joined in it. Squaws and children walked past the lodge, throwing money through the doorway. There were handfuls of notes crumpled like the sprouting leaves of rhubarb. Some of the money had been smeared with filth. The fire of a wolf pup burned in the eyes of a young boy who swung back his arm and hurled a piece of colored cloth wrapped around a rock. It struck against the back wall of the lodge, a cavalry guidon, crumpled and dirty. Bennington picked it up, looking at the bloodstains on the circle of gilt stars. A Cheyenne girl who could have been no more than three threw down a toy pony made of buckskin with a $10 bill tied on it as a saddle blanket. Daymire's eyes were alive and darting as the money began to litter the lodge floor. He snatched up a wallet with worn gold initials on it and a ragged bullet hole through it. There was money inside, a thick sheaf of notes stuck together with dried blood. Daymire took the notes and dropped the wallet into the fire pit. The long line ended. The Indian boys brought the white men's horses before the lodge with all their possessions on them. Daymire was on his hands and knees, scrabbling around the lodge.
Gather it up. Let's count it.
The amount was a little more than $2,000.
They held out on us. That's what they did. Go tell Sitting Bull we won't leave until...
We're leaving while we have the chance. They haven't got any more money. They told me they threw most of it away right at the battlefield.
Over 3 weeks ago. We'll go there just the same.
Sure.
Daymire was stuffing the money into the big pocket inside his shirt. A map and an army tinder kit took up too much room. He threw them into the fire pit.
I'll give you your share when you get me back to one of the forts, Bennington.
It was another week before they found the battlefield. Between tufts of reddish-brown grass, the soil was white and ashy on the hills above the blue loops of the Little Bighorn. The wolves and birds had been here, and the wind and rain, so that the fluffy earth heaped in haste upon the bodies of the dead was mostly gone now. Bennington got down and led his horse through the litter of rotting equipment scattered widely on the hills. Here and there were small heaps of McClellans and rifles with broken stocks, all partially burned, and the bottoms of cavalry boots with the tops cut off, already starting to curl in the sun, and horses sinking into the earth, and empty cartridge shells spilled in the grass. He did not count, but he knew that he had seen almost 100 bodies that had been covered with sagebrush only as a burial gesture. There were soldiers here that he had known, but there was no way of knowing them now. Higher up the hill, Daymeyer was searching furiously for money. Bennington went up to him and on beyond him, to where the basket from a travois was staked down over a grave. The only real grave that Bennington had seen. This would be the burial place of Custer, the yellow hair.
Keep looking, don't stand around.
Daymeyer plunged away toward a pair of pants hanging on a bush. Across the basket of the travois, Bennington looked down at the Sioux campsite on the other side of the river. It ran for miles. Someone had burned the lodge poles. Grass was already rising in the charred marks. Bennington led his horse down the hill to Daymeyer.
The Sioux lied. I haven't seen a single bill. You can't tell me that the other soldiers picked them all up. They weren't here long enough to even bury their dead. I tell you, the Sioux lied, and you...
Daymeyer was looking into the muzzle of Bennington's pistol. With his free hand, Bennington was pulling the cavalry guidon from under his shirt.
What's the idea?
I've been wanting to kill you for a long time.
You fool! I'll give you your third of the money.
Bennington shook his head.
Half the money, then.
With a slow motion, Bennington tossed the guidon to Daymeyer.
Pile it on, lad.
Bennington watched the notes tumbling from inside Daymeyer's shirt. He watched the man counting.
Put it all down there.
Daymeyer was like a cornered wolf, but he saw the curious listlessness in Bennington's eyes. He obeyed. The money lay on the stained guidon and on the ashy soil around it. Bennington tossed down his tinder kit.
You're crazy! No, I won't!
Burn it.
You're crazy!
Burn it.
That's senseless, Bennington. It won't help them. It won't help anybody. You've gone Injun. You're starting to believe that story you told to Sue about honoring the...
Death was all around Daymeyer, and death was looking at him. His hands trembled as he ignited the tinder. As the little fire burned, Daymeyer stared down in anguish. His heart was truly on the ground, where the wisps of smoke were dying away.
Why'd you do that, Bennington?
With the pistol, Bennington motioned for Daymeyer to walk away from him. The man started.
To think I saved your life!
I just saved yours. Now get out of my sight, Daymeyer.
Bennington rode away from the mutilation and horror. From a hill above the high bluffs on the river, he looked back and saw Daymeyer going toward the Indian campsite. He would look there for money. He would look forever for money. When Daymeyer was completely out of sight, Bennington began to feel free and clean once more. He turned the tired gray horse toward the Rosebud.